warned, "or you'll end up as dog's meat, and I won't lift a hand to save you." Jamie, meanwhile, was slowly walking toward the dogs, one hand held out fist-like toward them. What had seemed a large pack was only four dogs, a small brownish rat terrier, two ruffed and spotted shepherds, and a huge black and tan monster that could have stood in for the Hound of the Baskervilles with no questions asked. This slavering creature stretched out a neck thicker than my waist and sniffed gently at the proffered knuckles. A tail like a ship's cable beat back and forth with increasing fervour. Then it flung back its enormous head, baying with joy, and leapt on its master, knocking him flat in the road. "In which Odysseus returns from the Trojan War and is recognised by his faithful hound," I remarked to Adonis, who snorted briefly, giving his opinion either of Homer or of the undignified display of emotion going on in the roadway. Jamie, laughing, was ruffling the fur and pulling the ears of the dogs, who were all trying to lick his face at once. Finally, he beat them back sufficiently to rise, keeping his feet with difficulty against their ecstatic demonstrations. "Well, someone's glad to see me at any rate," he said, grinning as he patted the beast's head. "That's Luke," he pointed to the terrier, "and Elphin and Mars. Brothers they are, and bonny sheepdogs. And this..." He laid an affectionate hand on the enormous black head, which slobbered in appreciation, "is Bran."
"I'll take your word for it," I said, cautiously extending a knuckle to be sniffed. "What is he?"
"A staghound."
He scratched the pricked ears, quoting,
"Thus Fingal chews his hounds, eye like slough, ear like leaf, chest like horse, hoof like sickle, and the tail joint far from the head."
"If those are the qualifications, then you're right," I said, inspecting Bran. "If his tail joint were any further from his head, you could ride him."
"I used to, when I was small. Not Bran, I don't mean, but his grandfather, Nairn."
He gave the hound a final pat, and straightened, gazing toward the house. He took the restive Donas's bridle and turned him downhill.
"In which Odysseus returns to his home disguised as a beggar," he quoted in Greek, having picked up my earlier remark. "And now," he said, straightening his collar with some grimness, "I suppose it's time to go and deal with Penelope and her suitors."
When we reached the double doors, the dogs panting at our heels, Jamie hesitated. "Should we knock?" I asked, a bit nervous. He looked at me in astonishment.
"It's my home," he said,
and pushed the door open. He led me through the house, ignoring the few startled servants we passed, past the entrance hall, and through a small gun room into the drawing room. It boasted a wide hearth with a polished mantel, and bits of silver and glass gleamed here and there, capturing the late afternoon sun. For a moment I thought the room was empty. Then I saw a faint movement in one corner near the hearth. She was smaller than I had expected. With a brother like Jamie, I had imagined her at least my height, or even taller. But the woman by the fire barely reached 5 feet. Her back was to us as she reached for something on the shelf of the china cabinet, and the ends of her dress sash dipped close to the floor. Jamie froze when he saw her.
"Jenny," he said.
The woman turned, and I caught an impression of brows black as ink squills, and blue eyes wide in a white face before she launched herself at her brother.
"Jamie!"
Small as she was, she jarred him with the impact of her embrace. His arms went about her shoulders in reflex, and they clung for a moment, her face tight against his shirt front, his hand tender on the nape of her neck. On his face was an expression of such mingled uncertainty and yearning joy that I felt almost an intruder. Then she pressed herself closer to him, murmuring something in Gaelic, and his expression dissolved in shock. He grasped her by the arms and held her away from him, looking down. The faces were much alike, the same oddly slanted dark blue eyes and broad cheekbones, the same thin, blade-bridged nose, just a trifle too long,
but she was dark where Jamie was fair, with cascades of black curly hair bound back with green ribbon. She was beautiful, with clear-drawn features and alabaster skin. She was also clearly in a state of advanced pregnancy. Jamie had gone white at the lips. "Jenny," he whispered, shaking his head. "Oh, Jenny McCree." Her attention was distracted just then by the appearance of a small child in the doorway, and she pulled away from her brother without noticing his discomposure. She took the little boy's hand and led him into the room, murmuring encouragement. He hung back a little, thumb in mouth for comfort, peering up at the strangers from behind his mother's skirts. For his mother, she plainly was. He had her mop of thick, curly black hair and the square set of her shoulders, though the face wasn't hers. "This is wee Jamie," she said, looking proudly down at the lad. "And this is your uncle Jamie McCree, the one you're named for."
"For me? You named him for me?"
Jamie looked like a fighter who has just been punched very hard in the stomach. He backed away from mother and child until he blundered into a chair and sank into it as though the strength had gone from his legs. He hid his face in his hands. His sister by this time was aware that something was amiss. She touched him tentatively on the shoulder.
"Jimmy, what is it, my dearie? Are you ill?"
He looked up at her then, and I could see his eyes were full of tears.
"Did you have to do that, Jenny? Do you think that I've not suffered enough for what happened, for what I let happen? That you must name Randall's bastard for me, to be a reproach to me so long as I live?"
Jenny's face, normally pale, lost all vestiges of colour.
"Randall's bastard?" she said blankly. "John Randall, you mean? The Red Coat Captain?"
"Aye, the Red Coat Captain. Who else would I mean, for God's sake? You'll remember him, I suppose."
Jamie was recovering enough of his customary poise for sarcasm. Jenny eyed her brother closely, one arched brow lifted in suspicion.
"Have you lost your senses, man?" she inquired.
"Or have you taken a drop too much along the way?"
"I should never have come back," he muttered.
He rose then, stumbling slightly, and tried to pass without touching her. She stood her ground, however, and gripped him by the arm.
"Correct me, brother, if I'm wrong," Jenny said slowly, "but I've the strong impression you're saying I've played the whore to Captain Randall, and what I'm asking myself is what maggots you've got in your brain to make you say so."
"Maggots, is it?"
Jamie turned to her, mouth twisted with bitterness.
"I wish it were so. I'd rather I was dead and in my grave than to see my sister brought to such a pass."
He seized her by the shoulders and shook her slightly, crying out,
"Why, Jenny, why? To have you ruin yourself for me was shame enough to kill me. But this..."
He dropped his hands then with a gesture of despair that took in the protruding belly, swelling accusingly under the light smocking. He turned abruptly toward the door, and an elderly woman who had been listening avidly with the child clinging to her skirts drew back in alarm.
"I shouldn't have come. I'll go."
"You'll do no such thing, Jamie Fraser," his sister said sharply. "Not before you've listened to me."
"Sit yourself down then, and I'll tell you about Captain Randall, since you want to know." "I don't want to know. I don't want to hear it."
As she advanced toward him, he turned sharply away to the window that looked out over the yard. She followed him, saying, "Jamie..." But he repelled her with a violent gesture.
"No, don't talk to me. I've said I cannae bear to hear it."
"Oh, is that a fact?"
She eyed her brother, standing at the window with his legs braced wide apart, hands on the sill and back stubbornly set against her. She bit her lip, and a calculating look came over her face. Quick as lightning, she stooped, and her hand shot under his kilt like a striking snake. Jamie let out a roar of sheer outrage and stood bolt upright with shock. He tried to turn, then froze as she apparently tightened her grip.
"There's men as are sensible," she said to me with a wicked smile,
and beasts as are biddable. Others you'll do nothing with unless you have 'em by the bollocks. Now, you can listen to me in a civil way, she said to her brother, or I can twist a bit. Eh?
He stood still, red-faced, breathing heavily through clenched teeth.
I'll listen, he said, and then I'll wring your wee neck, Janet. Let me go.
No sooner did she oblige than he whirled on her.
What in hell do you think you're doing? He demanded. Trying to shame me before my own wife?
Jenny wasn't fazed by his outrage. She rocked back on her heels, viewing her brother and me sardonically.
Well, and if she's your wife, I expect she's more familiar with your balls than what I am.
I haven't seen them myself since you got old enough to wash alone.
Grown a bit, no?
Jamie's face went through several alarming transformations as the dictates of civilized behavior struggled with the primitive impulse of a younger brother to clout his sister over the head. Civilization at length won out, and he said through his teeth, with what dignity he could summon, "Leave my balls out of it.
And then, since you'll not rest till you make me hear it, tell me about Randall. Tell me why you disobeyed my orders and chose to dishonour yourself and your family instead."
Jenny put her hands on her hips and drew herself to her full height, ready for combat. Slower than he to lose her temper, still she had one, no doubt of that.
"Oh, disobey your orders, is it?
That's what eats at you, Jamie, isn't it? You know best. And we'll all do as you say, or we'll come to rack and ruin thee, doot."
She flounced angrily. "And if I'd done as you said that day, you'd have been dead in the dooryard, father hanged or in prison for killing Randall, and the land's gone forfeit to the crown. To say nothing of me, with my home and family gone, needing to beg in the byroads to live." Not pale at all now, Jamie was flushed with anger.
"Aye. So you choose to sell yourself rather than beg. I'd sooner have died in my blood and seen father and the lands in hell along with me. And well you know it."
"Aye, I know it. You're a ninny, Jamie, and always have been," his sister returned in exasperation.
"Fine thing for you to say. You're not content with ruining your good name and my own. You must go on with the scandal and flaunt your shame to the whole neighbourhood."
"You'll not speak to me that way, James Fraser, brother or no. What do you mean, my shame, you great fool, you?"
"What I mean? When you're going about swelled out to here like a mad toad."
He mimicked her belly with a contemptuous swipe of the hand. She took one step back, drew back her hand and slapped him with all the force she could muster. The impact jarred his head back and left a white outline of her fingers printing on his cheek. He slowly raised a hand to the mark, staring at his sister. Her eyes were glittering dangerously and her bosom heaved. The words spilled out in a torrent between clenched white teeth.
"Toad, is it? Stinking coward! You've no more courage than to leave me here thinking you're dead or imprisoned with no word from one day to the next. And then you come strolling in one fine day, with a wife no less, and sit in my drawing-room calling me toad and harlot and..."
"I didn't call you harlot, but I should. How can you?"
Despite the differences in their heights, brother and sister were almost nose to nose, hissing at one another in an effort to keep their carrying voices from ringing through the old manor house. The effort was largely wasted, judging from the glimpses I caught of various interested faces peeping discreetly from kitchen, hall and window. The Laird of Broch Tuach was having an interesting homecoming, to be sure. I thought it best to let them have it out without my presence, and so I stepped quietly into the hall, with an awkward nod to the elderly woman, and continued into the yard. There was a small arbour there, with a bench, on which I seated myself, looking about with interest. Besides the arbour there was a small walled garden, blooming with the last of the summer roses. Beyond it was what Jamie referred to as the Dewcot, or so I assumed, from the assorted pigeons that were fluttering in and out of the pierced work opening at the top of the building. I knew there was a barn and a shed for silage. These must be to the other side of the house, with the farm's granary and the henyard, kale yard and disused chapel, which still left a small stone building on this side unaccounted for. The light autumn wind was from that direction. I sniffed deeply and was rewarded with the rich smell of hops and yeast. That was the brew house, then, where the beer and ale for the estate were made. The road past the gate led up and over a small hill. As I looked, a small group of men appeared at the crest, silhouetted in the evening light. They seemed to hover a moment, as though taking leave of each other. This appeared to be the case, for only one came down the hill toward the house, the others striking off through the fields toward a clump of cottages in the distance. As a single man came down the hill, I could see that he limped badly. When he came through the gate, the reason for it was apparent. The right leg was missing below the knee, and he wore a wooden peg in replacement. In spite of the limp, he moved youthfully. In fact, as he drew near to the arbour, I could see that he was only in his 20s. He was tall, nearly as tall as Jamie, but much narrower through the shoulder, thin, in fact, nearly to the point of skinniness. He paused at the entrance to the arbour, leaning heavily on the lattice, and looked in at me with interest. Thick brown hair fell smoothly over a high brow, and deep-set brown eyes held a look of patient good humour. The voices of Jamie and his sister had risen while I waited outside. The windows were open to the warm weather, and the disputants were quite audible from the arbour, though not all the words were clear. "Interfering, nosy bitch," came Jamie's voice, loud on the soft evening air. "Haven't you the decency to—" His sister's reply was lost in a sudden breeze. The newcomer nodded easily toward the house. "Ah, Jamie's home, then?" I nodded in reply, not sure whether I should introduce myself. It didn't matter, for the young man smiled and inclined his head to me. "I'm Ian Murray, Jenny's husband, and I imagine he'll be—" "Ah, the Sassenach wench Jamie's married," I finished for him. "My name is Claire." "Did you know about it, then?" I asked as he laughed. My mind was racing. "Jenny's husband?" "Oh, aye. We heard from Joe Orr, who got it from a tinker in Ardrey. You can't keep anything secret long in the Highlands. You should know that, even if you've been wed as little as a month. Jenny's been wondering for weeks what you'd be like." "Whore!" Jamie bellowed from inside the house. Jenny's husband didn't turn a hair, but went on examining me with friendly curiosity. "You're a bonny lass," he said, looking me over frankly. "Are you fond of Jamie?" "Well, yes. Yes, I am," I answered, a bit taken aback. I was becoming accustomed to the directness that characterised most Highlanders, but it still took me unawares from time to time. He pursed his lips and nodded as though satisfied, and sat down beside me on the bench. "Better let them have a few minutes longer," he said with a wave at the house, where the shouting had now turned to Gaelic. He seemed completely unconcerned as to the cause of the battle. "Frasers dinna listen to anything when they've their dander up. When they've shouted themselves out, sometimes you can make them see reason, but not till then." "Yes, I noticed," I said dryly, and he laughed. "So you've been wed long enough to find that out, eh? We heard as how Dougal made Jamie wed you," he said, ignoring the battle and concentrating his attention on me. "But Jenny said it would take more than Dougal Mackenzie to make Jamie do something he didna care to. Now that I see you, of course, I can see why he did it." He lifted his brows, inviting further explanation, but politely not forcing it. "I imagine he had his reasons," I said, my attention divided between my companion and the house, where the sounds of combat continued. "I don't want... I mean, I hope..." Ian correctly interpreted my hesitations and my glance toward the drawing-room windows. "Oh, I expect you something to do with it, but she'd take it out of him whether you were here or not. She loves Jamie something fierce, you know, and she worried a lot while he was gone, especially with her father going so sudden. You'll know about that." The brown eyes were sharp and observant, as though to gauge the depth of confidence between me and Jamie. Yes, Jamie told me.
Ah.
He nodded toward the house.
Then, of course, she's with child.
Yes, I noticed that too, I said.
Hard to miss, is it no?
Ian answered with a grin. And we both laughed.
Makes her fratchety, he explained. Not that I blame her, but it would take a braver man than me to cross words with a woman in her 9th month.
He leaned back, stretching his wooden leg out in front of him.
Lost it at Domier with Fergus Nicleodas, he explained. Grape shot. Aches a wee bit toward the end of the day.
He rubbed the flesh just above the leather cuff that attached the peg to his stump. Have you tried rubbing it with balm of Gilead? I asked. Water pepper or stewed rue might help, too.
I've not tried the water pepper, he answered, interested. I'll ask Jenny, does she know how to make it?
Oh, I'll be glad to make it for you, I said, liking him. I looked toward the house again. If we stay long enough, I added doubtfully. We chatted inconsequentially for a little, both listening with one ear to the confrontation going on beyond the window, until Ian hitched forward, carefully settling his artificial limb under him before rising.
I imagine we should go in now. If either of them stop shouting long enough to hear the other, they'll be hurting each other's feelings.
I hope that's all they heard.
Ian chuckled.
Oh, I didn't think Jamie would strike her. He's used to forbearance in the face of provocation. As for Jenny, she might slap his face, but that's all.
She already did that?
Well, the guns are locked up and all the knives are in the kitchen, except what Jamie's wearing. And I don't suppose he'll let her close enough to get his dirk away from him. Nay, they're safe enough.
He paused at the door.
Now, as for you and me...
He winked solemnly.
That's a different matter.
Inside, the maid started and flitted nervously away at Ian's approach. The housekeeper, though, was still hovering by the drawing-room door in fascination, drinking in the scene within, Jamie's namesake cradle against her capacious bosom. Such was her concentration that when Ian spoke to her, she jumped as though he had run a hatpin into her and put a hand to her palpitating heart. Ian nodded politely to her, took the little boy in his arms, and led the way into the drawing-room. We paused just inside the door to survey the scene. Brother and sister had paused for breath, both still bristling and glaring like a pair of angry cats. Small Jamie, spotting his mother, struggled and kicked to get down from Ian's arms, and once on the floor made for her like a homing pigeon.
"Mama!" he cried. "Up! Jamie, up!"
Turning, she scooped up the little boy and held him like a weapon against her shoulder.
"Can you tell your uncle how old you are, sweetheart?"
she asked him, throttling her voice down to a coo, under which the sound of clashing steel was still all too apparent. The boy heard it. He turned and burrowed his face into his mother's neck. She patted his back mechanically, still glaring at her brother. "Since he'll not tell you, I will. He's 2. Come last August. And if you're bright enough to count, which I take leave to doubt, you'll see he was conceived 6 months past the time I last saw yon Randall, which was in our own dooryard beating the living daylights out of my brother with a sabre."
"That's so, is it?" Jamie glowered at his sister. "I've heard a bit differently. It's common knowledge you've taken the man to your bed, not the once, but as your lover. That child's his."
He nodded contemptuously at his namesake, who had turned to peer under his mother's chin at this big, loud stranger.
"I believe you when you say the new bastard you're carrying is not. Randall was in France till this March, so you're not only a whore, but an unchoosy one, too. Who fathered this last devil spawn on you?"
The tall young man beside me coughed apologetically, breaking the tension in the room.
"I did," he said mildly. "That one, too."
Advancing stiffly on his wooden leg, he took the little boy from his fuming wife and set him in the crook of his arm.
"Favours me a bit, some say."
In fact, seen side by side, the faces of man and boy were nearly identical, allowing for the round cheeks of the one and the crooked nose of the other. The same high brow and narrow lips. The same feathery brows arched over the same deep liquid brown eyes. Jamie, staring at the pair of them, looked rather as though he'd been hit in the small of the back with a sandbag. He closed his mouth and swallowed once, clearly having no idea what to do next.
"Ian,"
he said, a little weakly.
"You're married, then?"
"Oh, aye," his brother-in-law said cheerfully. "Wouldn't do otherwise, would it?"
"I see,"
Jamie murmured. He cleared his throat and bobbed his head at his newly discovered brother-in-law.
It's kind of you, Ian, to take her, I mean. Most kind."
Feeling that he might be in need of some moral support at this point, I moved to Jamie's side and touched his arm. His sister's eyes lingered on me speculatively, but she said nothing. Jamie looked around and seemed startled to find me there as though he had forgotten my existence. And no wonder if he had, I thought. But he seemed relieved by the interruption, at least, and put out a hand to draw me forward.
"My wife," he said, rather abruptly.
He nodded toward Jenny and Ian.
"My sister and her,
He trailed off as Ian and I exchanged polite smiles. Jenny wasn't to be distracted by social niceties.
"What do you mean, it's kind of him to take me?"
she demanded, ignoring the introductions.
"As if I didn't ken."
Ian looked inquiringly at her, and she waved a disdainful hand at Jamie.
"He means it was kind of you to wed me in my soiled condition."
She gave a snort that would have done credit to someone twice her size.
"Blethera!"
"Soiled condition?"
Ian looked startled, and Jamie suddenly leaned forward and grasped his sister hard about the upper arm.
"Did you not tell him about Randall?"
He sounded truly shocked.
"Jenny, how could you do such a thing?"
Only Ian's hand on Jenny's other arm restrained her from flying at her brother's throat. Ian drew her firmly behind him, and turning, set small Jamie in her arms, so that she was forced to grasp the child to save him falling. Then Ian put an arm about Jamie's shoulders and tactfully steered him a safe distance away. "It's hardly a matter for the drawing room," he said, low-voiced and deprecating, "but you might be interested to know that your sister was virgin on her wedding night. I was, after all, in a position to say." Jenny's wrath was now more or less evenly divided between brother and husband.
"How dare you to say such things in my presence, Ian Murray," she flamed, "or out of it either. My wedding night's no one's business but mine and yours. Sure it's not his. Next you'll be showing him the sheets from a bridal bed."
"Well, if I did now, it would shut him up, no?" said Ian soothingly. "Come now, me do. You should no worrit yourself. It's bad for the babe. And the shouting troubles wee Jamie too."
He reached out for his son, who was whimpering, not sure yet whether the situation required tears. Ian jerked his head at me and rolled an eye in Jamie's direction. Taking my cue, I grabbed Jamie by the arm and dragged him to an armchair in a neutral corner. Ian had Jenny likewise installed on the love seat, a firm arm across her shoulders to keep her in place.
"Now then."
In spite of his unassuming manner, Ian Murray had an undeniable authority. I had my hand on Jamie's shoulder and could feel the tension begin to go out of it. I thought that the room looked a bit like the ring of a boxing match, with the fighters twitching restlessly in the corners, each awaiting the signal for action under the soothing hand of a manager. Ian nodded at his brother-in-law, smiling.
"Jamie, it's good to see you, man. We're pleased you're home and your wife with you."
"Are we not, my dude?"
he demanded of Jenny, his fingers tightening perceptibly on her shoulder.
She wasn't one to be forced into anything, her lips compressed into a thin, tight line as though forming a seal, then opened reluctantly to let one word escape.
"Depends,"
she said, and shut them tight again. Jamie rubbed a hand over his face, then raised his head, ready for a fresh round.
"I saw you go into the house with Randall,"
he said stubbornly, "and from things he said to me later. How comes he to know you've a mole on your breast, then?" She snorted violently. "Do you remember all that went on that day? Or did the captain beat it out of you with his sabre?"
"Of course I remember. I'm no likely to forget it."
"Then perhaps you'll remember that I gave the captain a fair jolt in the clutch with my knee at one point in the proceedings."
Jamie hunched his shoulders, wary.
"Aye, I remember."
Jenny smiled in a superior manner.
"Well then, if your wife here... You could tell me her name at least, Jamie. I swear you've no manners at all. Anyway, if she was to give you similar treatment, and richly you deserve it, I might add, do you think you'd be able to perform your husbandly duties a few minutes later?"
Jamie, who'd been opening his mouth to speak, suddenly shut it. He stared at his sister for a long moment, then one corner of his mouth twitched slightly.
"Depends," he said.
The mouth twitched again. He had been sitting hunched forward in his chair, but sat back now, looking at her with the half-sceptical expression of a younger brother listening to a sister's fairy tales, feeling himself too old to be amazed, but half-believing still against his will.
"Really?" he said.
Jenny turned to Ian. "Go and fetch the sheets, Ian," she ordered. Jamie raised both hands in surrender.
"No, no, I believe you. It's just... the way he acted after."
Jenny sat back, relaxed in the curve of Ian's arm, her son cuddling as close as the bulk of her belly would permit, gracious in victory.
"Well, after all he'd said outside, he could hardly admit in front of his own men to being incapable now, could he? He'd have to seem as though he'd done as he promised, no?
And," she admitted, "I'll have to see the man was very unpleasant about it all. He did strike me and tear my gown. In fact, he knocked me half senseless trying, and by the time I'd come to myself and got decently covered again, the English had gone, taking you along with them."
Jamie gave a long sigh and closed his eyes briefly. His broad hands rested on his knees, and I covered one of them with a gentle squeeze. He took my hand and opened his eyes, giving me a faint smile of acknowledgement before turning back to his sister.
"All right," he said. "But I want to know, Jenny, did you know when you went with him that he'd not harm you?"
She was silent for a moment, but her gaze was steady on her brother's face. And at last she shook her head, a slight smile on her lips. She put out a hand to stop Jamie's protest, and the gull-winged brows rose in a graceful arc of inquiry. "And if your life is a suitable exchange for my honour, tell me why my honour is not a suitable exchange for your life." The brows drew together in a scowl, the twin of the one adorning her brother's face. "Or are you telling me that I may not love you as much as you love me? Because if you are Jamie Fraser, I'll tell you right now, it's not true." Opening his mouth to reply before she was finished, Jamie was taken suddenly at a loss by this conclusion. He closed his mouth abruptly as his sister pressed her advantage.
"Because I do love you, for all you're a thick-headed, slack-witted, lack-brained gomeral, and I'll no have you dead in the road at my feet just because you're too stubborn to keep your mouth shut for the once in your life."
Blue eyes glared into blue, shooting sparks in all directions. Swallowing the insults with difficulty, Jamie struggled for a rational reply. He seemed to be making up his mind to something. Finally, he squared his shoulders, resigned to it.
"All right, then. I'm sorry," he said. "I was wrong, and I'll beg your pardon."
He and his sister sat staring at each other for a long moment, but whatever pardon he was expecting from her was not forthcoming. She examined him closely, biting her lip, but said nothing. Finally, he grew impatient.
"I've said I'm sorry. What more do you want of me?" he demanded. "Do you want me to go on my knees to you? I'll do it if I must, but tell me."
She shook her head slowly, lip still caught between her teeth.
"No," she said at last. "I'll not have you on your knees in your own house.
Stand up, though."
Jamie stood, and she set the child down on the love seat and crossed the room to stand in front of him.
"Take off your shirt," she ordered.
"I'll not."
She jerked the shirt tail out of his kilt and reached for the buttons. Short of forcible resistance, clearly he was going to obey or submit to being undressed. Retaining as much dignity as he could, he backed away from her and, tight-lipped, removed the disputed garment. She circled behind him and surveyed his back, her face displaying the same carefully blank expression I had seen Jamie adopt when concealing some strong emotion. She nodded, as though confirming something long suspected.
"Well, and if you've been a fool, Jamie, it seems you've paid for it."
She laid her hand gently on his back, covering the worst of the scars.
"It looks as though it hurt."
"It did."
"Did you cry?"
His fists clutch involuntarily at his sides.
"Yes."
Jenny walked back around to face him, pointed chin lifted and slanted eyes wide and bright.
"So did I," she said softly. "Every day since they took you away."
The broad-cheeked faces were once more mirrors of each other, but the expression that they wore was such that I rose and stepped quietly through the kitchen door to leave them alone. As the door swung to behind me, I saw Jamie catch hold of his sister's hands and say something huskily in Gaelic. She stepped into his embrace, and the rough, bright head bent to the dark. Chapter 27 The Last Reason. We ate like wolves at dinner, retired to a large, airy bedroom, and slept like logs. The sun would have been high by the time we rose in the morning, save that the sky was covered in clouds. I could tell it was late by the bustling feel of the house, as of people going cheerfully about their business, and by the tempting aromas that drifted up the stairs. After breakfast, the men prepared to go out, visiting tenants, inspecting fences, mending wagons, and generally enjoying themselves. As they paused in the hall to don their coats, Ian spotted Jenny's large basket resting on the table beneath the hall mirror.
"Shall I fetch home some apples from the orchard, Jenny? It would save you walking so far." "Good idea," said Jamie, casting an appraising eye at his sister's expansive frontage. "We dinna want her to drop it in the road."
"I'll drop you where you stand, Jamie Fraser," she retorted, calmly holding up the coat for Ian to shrug into. "Be useful for the once, and take this wee fiend outside with you. Mrs. Crook's in the wash-house. You can leave him there."
She moved her foot, dislodging small Jamie, who was clinging to her skirts, chanting, "Up, up," monotonously. His uncle obediently grabbed the wee fiend around the middle and swept him out the door, upside down and shrieking with delight.
"Ah," Jenny sighed contentedly, bending to inspect her appearance in the gold-framed mirror.
She wet a finger and smoothed her brows, then finished doing up the buttons at her throat.
"Nice to finish dressing without someone clinging to your skirts or wrapped round your knees. Some days I can scarce go to the privy alone or speak a single sentence without being interrupted."
Her cheeks were slightly flushed, and her dark hair gleamed against the blue silk of her dress. Ian smiled at her, warm brown eyes glowing at the blooming picture she presented.
"Well, you'll have time to talk with Claire, perhaps," he suggested.
He cocked one eyebrow in my direction.
"I expect she's mannerly enough to listen. But for God's sake, dinna tell her any of your poems, or she'll be on the next coach to London before Jamie and I get back."
Jenny snapped her fingers under his nose, unperturbed by the teasing.
"I'm none too worried, man. There's no coach going before next April, and I reckon she'll be used to us by that time. Get on with you. Jamie's waiting."
While the men went about their business, Jenny and I spent the day in the parlour, she stitching, I winding up stray bits of yarn and sorting the coloured silks. Outwardly friendly, we circled each other cautiously in conversation, watching each other from the corners of our eyes. Jamie's sister, Jamie's wife. Jamie was the central point, unspoken, about which our thoughts revolved. Their shared childhood linked them forever, like the warp and the weft of a single fabric, but the patterns of their weave had been loosened by absence and suspicion, then by marriage. Ian's thread had been present in their weaving since the beginning. Mine was a new one. How would the tensions pull in this new pattern, one thread against another? Our conversation ran on casual lines, but with the words unspoken clearly heard beneath. You've run the house here alone since your mother died.
Oh, aye, since I was 10.
I had the nurturing and the loving of him as a boy. What will you do with the man I helped make?
Jamie says as you're a rare fine healer.
I mended his shoulder for him when we first met.
Yes, I am capable and kind.
I will care for him.
I hear ye marry very quickly.
Did you wed my brother for his land and money?
Yes, it was quick. I didn't even know Jamie's true surname until just before the ceremony.
I didn't know he was laird of this place. I can only have married him for himself.
And so it went through the morning, a light luncheon, and into the hours of the afternoon, as we exchanged small talk, titbits of information, opinions, small and hesitant jokes, taking each other's measure. A woman who had run a large household since the age of 10, who had managed the estate since her father's death and her brother's disappearance, wasn't a person to be lightly esteemed. I did wonder what she thought of me, but she seemed as capable as her brother of hiding her thoughts when she chose to. As the clock on the mantelpiece began to strike 5, Jenny yawned and stretched, and the garment she'd been mending slid down the rounded slope of her belly onto the floor. She began clumsily to reach for it, but I dropped to my knees beside her.
No, I'll get it.
Thank you,
Claire.
Her first use of my name was accompanied by a shy smile, and I returned it. Before we could return to our conversation, we were interrupted by the arrival of Mrs. Crook, the housekeeper, who poked a long nose into the parlour and inquired worriedly whether we had seen wee Master Jamie. Jenny laid aside her sewing with a sigh.
"Got away again, has he?
Nae worry, Lizzie. He's likely gone wi' his da or his uncle. We'll go and see, shall we, Claire? I could use a breath of air before supper." She rose heavily to her feet and pressed her hands against the small of her back. She groaned and gave me a wry smile.
"3 weeks, about. I canna wait."
We walked slowly through the grounds outside, Jenny pointing out the brew house and the chapel, explaining the history of the estate and when the different bits had been built. As we approached the corner of the dovecot, we heard voices in the arbour.
"There he is, the wee rascal," Jenny exclaimed. "Wait till I lay hands on him."
"Wait a minute." I laid a hand on her arm, recognising the deeper voice that underlaid the little boy's.
"Dinna worry yourself, man," said Jamie's voice. "You'll learn. It's a bit difficult, isn't it, when your cock doesn't stick out any farther than your belly button?"
I stuck my head around the corner to find him seated on a chopping block, engaged in converse with his namesake, who was struggling manfully with the folds of his smock.
"What are you doing with the child?" I inquired cautiously.
"I'm teaching young James here the fine art of not pissing on his feet," he explained. "Seems the least his uncle could do for him."
I raised one eyebrow.
"Talk is cheap. Seems the least his uncle could do is show him."
He grinned.
"Well, we've had a few practical demonstrations. Had a wee accident last time, though."
He exchanged accusatory looks with his nephew.
"Dinna look at me," he said to the boy. "It was all your fault. I told you to keep still."
"Ahem," said Jenny dryly, with a look at her brother and a matching one at her son. The smaller Jamie responded by pulling the front of his smock up over his head, but the larger one, unabashed, grinned cheerfully and rose from his seat, brushing dirt from his breeks. He set a hand on his nephew's swathed head and turned the little boy toward the house.
"To everything there is a season," he quoted, "and a time for every purpose under heaven. First we work, we James, and then we wash. And then, thank God, it's time for supper."
The most pressing matters of business attended to, Jamie took time the next afternoon to show me over the house. Built in 1702, it was indeed modern for its time, with such innovations as porcelain stoves for heating and a great brick oven built into the kitchen wall so that bread was no longer baked in the ashes of the hearth. The ground floor hallway, the stairwell, and the drawing room walls were lined with pictures. Here and there was a pastoral landscape or an animal study, but most were of the family and their connections. I paused before a picture of Jenny as a young girl. She sat on the garden wall, a red-leaved vine behind her. Lined up in front of her along the top of the wall was a row of birds, sparrows, a thrush, a lark, and even a pheasant, all jostling and sidling for position before their laughing mistress. It was quite unlike most of the formerly posed pictures, in which one ancestor or another glared out of their frames as though their collars were choking them. "My mother painted that," Jamie said, noting my interest. "She did quite a few of the others in the stairwell, but there are only two of hers in here. She always liked that one best herself." A large, blunt finger touched the surface of the canvas gently, tracing the line of the red-leaved vine.
"Those were Jenny's dame birds. Any time there was a bird found with a lame leg or a broken wing, whoever found it would bring it along, and indeed she'd have it healed and eating from her hand. That one always reminded me of Ian."
The finger tapped above the pheasant, wings spread to keep its balance, gazing at its mistress with dark, adoring eyes.
"You're awful, Jamie," I said, laughing.
"Is there one of you?"
"Oh, aye."
He led me to the opposite wall, near the window. Two red-haired, tartan-clad little boys stared solemnly out of the frame, seated with an enormous staghound. That must be Nairn, Bran's grandfather. Jamie and his older brother Willie, who had died of the smallpox at 11. Jamie couldn't have been more than 2 when it was painted, I thought. He stood between his elder brother's knees, one hand resting on the dog's head. Jamie had told me about Willie during our journey from Leoch one night by the fire at the bottom of a lonely glen. I remembered the small snake, carved of cherry wood, that he had drawn from his sporran to show me.
"Willie gave it me for my 5th birthday," he had said, finger gently stroking the sinuous curves.
It was a comical little snake, body writhing artistically, and its head turned back to peer over what would have been its shoulder, if snakes had shoulders. Jamie handed me the little wooden object, and I turned it over curiously. "What's this scratched on the underside? S-A-W-N-Y. Sony?"
"That's me," Jamie said,
ducking his head as though mildly embarrassed.
"It's a pet name, like, a play on my 2nd name, Alexander. It's what Willie used to call me."
The faces in the picture were very much alike. All the Fraser children had that forthright look that dared you to take them at less than their own valuation of themselves. In this portrait, though, Jamie's cheeks were rounded and his nose still snubbed with babyhood, while his brother's strong bones had begun to show the promise of the man within, a promise never kept. "Were you very fond of him?" I asked softly, laying a hand on his arm. He nodded, looking away into the flames on the hearth.
"Why?" he said with a faint smile. "He was 5 years older than I, and I thought he was God, or at least Christ. Used to follow him everywhere, or everywhere he'd let me, at least."
He turned away and wandered toward the bookshelves. Wanting to give him a moment alone, I stayed, looking out of the window. From this side of the house, I could see dimly through the rain the outline of a rocky, grass-topped hill in the distance. It reminded me of the fairy's dun where I had stepped through a rock and emerged from a rabbit hole. Only 6 months, but it seemed like a very long time ago. Jamie had come to stand beside me at the window. Staring absently out at the driving rain, he said,
There was another reason. The main one.
Reason? I said stupidly.
Why I married you.
Which was? I don't know what I expected him to say. Perhaps some further revelation of his family's contorted affairs. What he did say was more of a shock, in its way.
Because I wanted you.
He turned from the window to face me.
More than I ever wanted anything in my life,
he added softly. I continued staring at him, dumbstruck. Whatever I had been expecting, it wasn't this. Seeing my open-mouthed expression, he continued lightly,
When I asked my da how you knew which was the right woman, he told me when the time came I'd have no doubt. And I didn't. When I woke in the dark under that tree on the road to Leoch, with you sitting on my chest cursing me for bleeding to death, I said to myself, Jimmy Fraser, for all you canna see what she looks like, and for all she weighs as much as a good draught horse, this is the woman.
I started toward him, and he backed away, talking rapidly.
I said to myself, She's mended you twice in as many hours, my lad. Life among the Mackenzies being what it is, it might be as well to wed a woman as can staunch a wound and set broken bones. And I said to myself, Jimmy, lad, if her touch feels so bonny on your collarbone, imagine what it might feel like lower down.
He dodged around a chair.
Of course, I thought it might have just been the effects of spending 4 months in a monastery without benefits of female companionship. But then that ride through the dark together.
He paused to sigh theatrically, neatly evading my grab at his sleeve, with that lovely broad arse wedged between my thighs. He ducked a blow aimed at his left ear and sidestepped, getting a low table between us, and that rock-solid head thumping me in the chest. A small metal ornament bounced off his own head and went clanging to the floor. I said to myself... He was laughing so hard at this point that he had to gasp for breath between phrases.
"Jamie," I said, for all she's a Sassenach bitch. We a tongue like an adder's. We a bum like that. What does it matter if she's a face like a sheep?
I tripped him neatly and landed on his stomach with both knees as he hit the floor with a crash that shook the house. "You mean to tell me that you married me out of love?" I demanded. He raised his eyebrows, struggling to draw in breath.
"Have I not just been saying so?"
Grabbing me round the shoulders with one arm, he wormed the other hand under my skirt and proceeded to inflict a series of merciless pinches on that part of my anatomy he had just been praising. Returning to pick up her embroidery basket, Jenny sailed in at this point and stood eyeing her brother with some amusement. "And what are you up to, young Jamie, my lad?" she inquired, one eyebrow up.
"I'm making love to my wife," he panted,
breathless between giggling and fighting.
"Well, you could find a more suitable place for it," she said, raising the other eyebrow. "That floor'll give you splinters in your ass."
If Lallybroch was a peaceful place, it was also a busy one. Everyone in it seemed to stir into immediate life at cockcrow, and the farm then spun and whirred like a complicated bit of clockwork until after sunset, when one by one the cogs and wheels that made it run began to fall away, rolling off into the dark to seek supper and bed, only to reappear like magic in their proper places in the morning. So essential did every last man, woman, and child seem to the running of the place that I couldn't imagine how it had fared these last few years, lacking its master. Now, not only Jamie's hands, but mine as well, were pressed into full employment. For the first time, I understood the stern Scottish strictures against idleness that had seemed like mere quaintness before, or after, as the case might be. Idleness would have seemed not only a sign of moral decay, but an affront to the natural order of things. There were moments, of course, those small spaces of time, too soon gone, when everything seemed to stand still and existence is balanced on a perfect point, like the moment of change between the dark and the light, when both and neither surround you. I was enjoying such a moment on the evening of the second or third day following our arrival at the farmhouse. Sitting on the fence behind the house, I could see tawny fields to the edge of the cliff past the broch, and the mesh of trees on the far side of the pass, dimming to black before the pearly glow of the sky. Objects near and far away seemed to be at the same distance as their long shadows melted into the dusk. The air was chilly with a hint of the coming frost, and I thought I must go in soon, though I was reluctant to leave the still beauty of the place. I wasn't aware of Jamie approaching until he slid the heavy folds of a cloak around my shoulders. I hadn't realized quite how cold it was until I felt the contrasting warmth of the thick wool. Jamie's arms came around me with the cloak, and I nestled back against him, shivering slightly.
"I could see you shivering from the house," he said, taking my hands in his. "Catch a chill if you're not careful."
"And what about you?" I twisted about to look at him. Despite the increasing bite of the air, he looked completely comfortable in nothing but shirt and kilt, with no more than a slight reddening of the nose to show it wasn't the balmiest of spring evenings.
"Ah, well, I'm used to it. Scotsmen are none so thin-blooded as ye blue-nosed sovereigns."
He tilted my chin up and kissed my nose, smiling. I took him by the ears and adjusted his aim downward. It lasted long enough for our temperatures to have equalized by the time he released me, and the warm blood sang in my ears as I leaned back, balancing on the fence rail. The breeze blew from behind me, fluttering strands of hair across my face. He brushed them off my shoulders, spreading the ruffled locks out with his fingers so the setting sun shone through the strands.
"You look like you've a halo with the light behind you that way," he said softly. "An angel crowned with gold."
"And you?" I answered softly, tracing the edge of his jaw where the amber light sparked from his sprouting beard. "Why didn't you tell me before?" He knew what I meant. One eyebrow went up, and he smiled, half his face lit by the glowing sun, the other half in shadow.
"Well, I knew you didn't want to wed me. I'd no wish to burden you or make myself foolish by telling you then, when it was plain you'd lie with me only to honour vows you'd rather not have made."
He grinned, teeth white in the shadow, forestalling my protest.
"The first time, at least. Have my pride, woman."
I reached out and drew him to me, pulling him close, so that he stood between my legs as I sat on the fence. Feeling the faint chill of his skin, I wrapped my legs around his hips and enfolded him with the wings of my cloak. Under the sheltering fabric, his arms came tight around me, pressing my cheek against the smudged cambric of his shirt.
"My love," he whispered. "Oh, my love, I do want you so."
"Not the same thing, is it?" I said. "Loving and wanting, I mean." He laughed, a little huskily.
"Damn close, Sassenach, for me at least."
I could feel the strength of his wanting, hard and urgent. He stepped back suddenly, and stooping, lifted me from the fence. "Where are we going?" We were headed away from the house, toward the cluster of sheds in the shadow of the elm grove.
"To find a haystack."
Chapter 28. Kisses and Drawers. I gradually found my own place in the running of the estate, as Jenny could no longer manage the long walk to the tenants' cottages. I took to visiting them myself, accompanied sometimes by a stable lad, sometimes by Jamie or Ian. I took food and medicines with me, treated the sick as best I could, and made suggestions as to the improvement of health and hygiene, which were received with varying degrees of grace. At Lallybroch itself, I poked about the house and grounds, making myself useful wherever I could, mostly in the gardens. Besides the lovely little ornamental garden, the manor had a small herb garden and an immense kitchen garden, or kale yard, that supplied turnips, cabbages, and vegetable marrows. Jamie was everywhere, in the study with the account books, in the fields with the tenants, in the horse barn with Ian, making up for lost time. There was something more than duty or interest in it, too, I thought. We would have to leave soon, and he wanted to set things running in a path that would continue while he was gone.